And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 24th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and in the studio with me is Joanne Mapson, and she will be here for the entire hour. She's the author of 11 novels and a book of short stories. Hank and Chloe was her debut novel, and Blue Rodeo was made into a CBS TV movie starring Kris Kristofferson. The Wilder Sisters and Bad Girl Creek were Los Angeles Times bestsellers. Solomon's Oak won the American Library Association's RUSA Award for Women's Fiction. Many of her books have been BookSense titles and indie-bound choices. Joanne is core faculty and creator of the University of Alaska Anchorage's Low Residency MFA program in writing. She lives with her husband and their three Italian greyhounds in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Finding Casey has just been released, and that's the focus of our talk today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you in the studio. I hardly ever have anybody here.
Really?
Yeah, everybody's always on the phone, which is fine. But it's nice to have someone here for once. So talk about Finding Casey and where the novel came from.
Well, my previous novel, Solomon's Oak, dealt with a story I'd been trying to write for a long time. What happens to the family of a person when a person is kidnapped or disappears? How does the rest of the family go on? And I thought that Solomon's Oak resolved that pretty well. And just before it came out, the J.C. Dugard case broke, and I thought, oh, I really need to write a novel about what else happened, what happened to the sister who was kidnapped. So that was the beginning of it. I was settled in Santa Fe, so I could write start to finish about the book there. And I thought, this could easily happen. This is a state that had famous communes, Easy Rider kind of stuff. Dennis Hopper lived in Santa Fe for a while. So I just kind of took all those elements together and tried to tell the story the best that I could.
Did it start with one thing, though, one image, one character, one situation?
It did, and this is a true story. My friend Judy Hendricks, the writer, She has this beautiful kitchen and a collection of micaceous clay pots, which I envied terribly, and I wanted one very badly. So I went to Spanish Market, and it was very hot. It was like, I think it's in July or August, very hot. And all of the people set, all the artists set up their booths around the plaza and down the streets downtown. And I looked at micaceous pots, and I was just about done for the day, hadn't found one I could afford, and I stopped at this booth. A young girl was selling pots, and a white guy was there with her, and it creeped me out. It seemed like he had a lot of control over her. But anyway, I bought one of her pots at a greatly discounted price, and I took it home and sat around for a week with it. Then I decided I would season it and cook in it. When I opened the pot, inside was a blue ribbon from the Taos County State Fair for first prize. And I thought, that is just so odd that anyone would sell it with the ribbon. What if it was an accident? I bet she didn't mean to. And her name was on the ribbon, but it was hard to find her. And eventually I did. But that was the beginning. The mystery came from the pot. And you know, it's a dream image for a writer. Something's hidden in there and you can draw it out.
Interesting. You know, you talked about this a little while ago, and as I was reading Finding Casey, I was thinking about your other novels and how you take characters from previous novels and they find their way into subsequent novels. And I started thinking about like mystery series. Readers love series when they read mystery. And so it reminded me of that. And I wondered if that's your intention to kind of, you know, create sort of a more subtle series with bringing characters from one novel into the next.
I never thought that would be what I did, my early novels. And after my third novel, Shadow Ranch. I wrote Loving Chloe, that took up from where Hank and Chloe left off. And I realized these people were all part of the same neighborhood in my brain. So if I put them in close proximity, I could tell some stories that move laterally out from the plot, or I could continue with that character in another book, and the reader would be comfortable. Oh, Margaret Yearwood lives next door to Gloria and Joe Vigil. So that was fun. I am embarrassed to say this, but also sort of proud. I was sick a lot when I was a kid. My mom would park me on the couch, and she'd iron, and I would lay there and watch soap operas with her. And I believe that serial type of writing stories is ingrained in me from those early days.
And so many of us like that, whether it's from watching soap operas with our moms or just that storytelling. There's something in the brain where we want to see people continue and see how stories continue and how they turn out and evolve. And I mean, I love it.
I think that I can pick up any of my books, read the last chapter, and start writing from there. And that's just the way my storytelling seems to be. Wasn't anything I tried to court or make happen. It just is.
It's interesting. Read to us. Be nice to give listeners a taste of your work, especially those who may be unfamiliar. And, of course, those who are familiar will be happy.
Okay, I'll read a couple pages from the first chapter.
Okay.
Santa Fe, November 2005. Every house has a story to tell, and over time will make whoever lives there a character. What happens inside the walls eventually finds its way into the plaster, hardening into the marrow of time. Paint it, remodel it, or set it on fire, but no one can take away its history. At night when the house creaks, tell yourself that's settling. When the wind blows hard and the house shudders like an earthquake, say, foundations shift. It all comes down to earth and straw, and in time of drought or deluge, a dwelling will crumble. With it go a few stories. In 1960, the space this realtor is calling the master bedroom was a field where Indians grew corn. A century later, the great room was a stable for horses. One night, a Spaniard drank too much mezcal, stole one of the horses, and rode it up the dirt road that is now paved and lined with art galleries. It is said that mezcal came about when a bolt of lightning struck a maguey plant, and as such is called the nectar of the gods. It's also called aguardiente, fire water, and responsible for many a deed that seemed brave at the time and stupid the next morning. The horse thief galloped that gelding up the steps to what is now called El Farol, the bar the New York Times now rates as one of the best in the world. The oldest bar in Santa Fe, they call it, and he demanded more drink. They know nothing of age. I watched this woman with the realtor by her side going from room to room, heedless of the mouse that scurries across the kitchen floor into the cabinet where its babies wait. I pop open a cabinet, but do they notice? They see what they want to see, a room to fill with material treasures, loved ones, and ample food. They don't see a nursery for the baby that will surprise them, or expect the grief that arrives over time, or sometimes in a single moment. They smell pinon fires and kiva fireplaces, not the burning of the bird's nest in the flue. Underneath the foundation, shards of bone china tell the story of my life, and so many others, but will likely remain untouched. Just look at her face. She's imagining new glass in the windows will make everything clear, and that homemade curtains will shut out the unpleasant. A silk pillow for her head, new dishes on a shelf, touches that change things just enough to make it hers. Already she's in love, and what I know of love is this. It can fill a house and change it into a home. A home can make people happy for a while, but love has its betrayal and misunderstandings and eventual ends, and they're just as potent. This house has been sold over and over again, yet never truly owned by anyone but me. People come and go, parting with massive amounts of money for their name on a paper deed. In no time, they are on the move again, wanting more or different, enough never being enough, or perhaps wanting less, having bitten off more than they can chew. Ah, well, who knows what might happen when they move in. Outside, the wintry wind blusters through the cottonwood trees. Beneath the clay soil, the forsythia is hard at work, because in a few months' time, its nature is to bloom a furious yellow, promising spring. The wisteria that came all the way from China hangs on to the trellis, hoping for sun and nitrogen and its roots to be tenderly attended. Last spring, the hollyhocks flourished, and the albino hummingbird gorged herself on red flowers, raising twins also white. The truth is, there is no time here. There is only this moment, which becomes history the second it passes, and leads into the next moment, which is both a miracle and a curse when you're a ghost.
Thank you so much. That was Joanne Mapson reading from Finding Casey, published by Bloomsbury. I wanted to ask you about your characters, that you have several point of view characters in the book, and if it started that way, if you had that in mind, that you needed to tell the story from Gory's point of view and from Laurel slash...
the other girl.
The other girl, etc.
Oh, I always start out trying to write one narrative, and I always end up writing two or three different points of view. That's just something quirky to my writing. In a short story, I can stay in one narration, but I notice when I transitioned out of writing short stories into novels, I was starting to put in more than one narrative, which, you know, is against the rules according to Janet Burroway and all the creative writing classes. But I do think that narratives are changing. Many, many novels now have multiple points of view.
Yeah, well, what was I going to say? You were talking about Janet Burroway, and before that, the different points of view. Oh, short stories. That's right. I remember one of your first short stories I read, I think it was called The Red Nighty Network, which I loved and I still remember. And wonder about that, your transition from short stories to novels, how that happened, and do you ever write short stories anymore?
I write them on occasion. I don't send them out. I try to concentrate all my time on writing novels, plus I have writing students, so it doesn't give me a lot of time to play around. I think I transitioned into writing novels because the form wasn't long enough, and nobody wants to publish a 28-page short story. But, you know, novellas are also really a manageable form. I would like to try that at some point.
In terms of publishing short stories, because Faultline was your collection, I know a lot of writers, I mean, new writers tend to start that way with short stories. Do you think that's useful because you create a finished product in a relatively short time, or do you think it's so different from novel writing that if writing a novel is what you want to do, then go straight to writing a novel?
Actually, I think writers should start with writing poetry. Poetry teaches you how to use images, economy of language, rhythm, and a beginning, a middle, and an end. The sonnet form is a really good one to compare it to because it has a beginning, a complication, a turn, and then the aftermath. And novels follow that. I think it's great to write short stories. Some people can't do it. I don't know why. I think it's harder now for me to do that because I always have all these stories trying to get into the middle of things. Poetry, short stories, those are great proving ground for the novel. Imagine if you've never written anything and you sit down and say, I'm going to write a novel.
Right.
It's overwhelming.
And then, you know, a month later, you're still in the first chapter and you're going, I don't know if writing's for me. Finding Casey very much takes place in New Mexico, and you lived in Alaska, and you have novels set in Alaska. You're from California. A lot of your novels are set in California. How does place influence your writing? How does where you are influence what you're writing?
I love to write about the landscape. I love to find out what grows there, what kind of animals live there, what the geological history is. Any place that I can dig into and get something that I can use metaphorically, mm-hmm. I find fascinating. New Mexico is like chock full of violent history, and it's kind of recent, actually. So that's always fun for me. There are a lot of ghosts there. They have a ghost tour. One ghost is said to appear in the La Fonda restaurant in the middle where there used to be a well. This businessman shows up, and in true life, he like gambled away all of the money he was supposed to be bringing back to his business. And then in true life, he jumped down the well and killed himself. But apparently he shows up there enough that they have it on the ghost tour. And I don't know, I like to sort of let the place seep into me. Alaska was difficult to write about because it is all those words like majestic and grand and can really overshadow a narrative. Santa Fe, it's not a hospitable place to live, really. You're always worried about water. This last summer we had horrible heat, killed two trees because of heat shock. So I try to use that as well. And I'm kind of a homebody at this point in my life. I don't like traveling a whole lot. So it's fun to really dig in deep to a landscape.
And Santa Fe has, like you said, I mean, there's so much going on, as well as, you know, the water issues and you know, recent violence. There's communes and cults and various things that seem to center there for some reason versus Wyoming or, you know, I mean, different states seem to have their kind of attraction. So in Finding Casey, you have a group that seems familiar. Talk about that.
I did a lot of research on those communes, which in the 60s were like the epicenter, I think. I think about that and how many must have left when the first snow fell. You know, it's easy to live communally in a place with nice weather where things will grow. But there's still a community up there that has earth ships, those buildings that are made of tires that are supposed to be, you know, super conserving energy, warm in the winter and cool in the summer. And, you know, that was the cool thing to do, go live communally. I decided that if I use that kind of in the background rather than go into it in depth, I could allude to a lot of past violence that had happened without writing too graphically about it. And there actually was a place I tried to visit many times. It was an heirloom farm where they grew, you know, old varieties of vegetables, and they collected seeds for the repository, which is awesome. I tried to visit. They never wrote back to me, and then my husband and I drove up there and found that the place had been abandoned and it was on the market. And I thought, well, that's even better. So we just climbed the fence and walked around and took notes.
Interesting. Is that toward the end of the book, that where your characters are going and find the dog
yes.
running free? Is that the place?
That's the exact place, yeah.
So how much does your life and what's actual find its way into your books? I mean, I imagine that people you know are protected, or that if you're going to use anything from your life, you're going to create a composite, I would think, or somehow disguise what you're writing about, and yet you seem to very much allow what's around you to find its way into your fiction. So how do you transform it and take it and make it into something else?
I think in my first four books, I didn't do a very good job of establishing boundaries. I try to change everything so that it's sort of metaphorical, what I'm talking about, but people know where it came from. I was a lot more foolhardy in those books than I am now. Changing names isn't enough. Changing body types and places, it just really isn't enough. Mm-hmm. And a while ago, a couple of books ago, my agent said to me, why don't you just give the character his own story or her own story? Don't rely on the truth. And that was really freeing. Hmm. So I try to do that. But if you go to one of my family parties and someone tells a story, they all look at me and go, don't you write that down. Do not write about that.
And then what do?
I write about it.
Do you ever worry about lawsuits? And is that even, I mean, does that even really happen in fiction? It happens in nonfiction, but does that even happen in fiction?
It does happen in fiction. What's her name?
Yeah, Terry McMillan.
Terry McMillan.
Right.
She changed the names and the body type and on, and she still got sued. I don't think that the sewer won, but it was unnerving.
Right.
And, you know, we live in, like, a place where everybody sues everybody for mm-hmm. breathing wrong or having a hangnail. So, sure, I worry about that stuff. Mm. Mostly I worry about my dogs biting someone and then, you know, having
right.
to go live in a tent
right.
to pay for it.
I know a lot of writers have indemnity insurance, you know,
really?
In case they get sued.
I did not
yeah.
know.
Yeah,
I'm going to find out about that.
It's expensive, but, you know, somebody sues you for $100,000, $1 million, you know, an insurance policy that costs $2,000 might be a good investment.
Easy money. The woman who got sued for writing The Help, yeah, she was sued by one of the maids. The real maids in real life.
Maids.
And she only wanted like $70,000.
That's it?
Yeah, and I'm like, wow, I wonder why she didn't go for a bigger number.
Right.
Crazy.
We're going to take a real short break. Stay with us. We'll be back with Joanne in the second half. Don't go anywhere.
Darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers in Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm here today with Joanne Mapson, and her new book is Finding Casey. If you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com, and there's lots of stuff there that you can find, and soon I'll list a bunch of events going on around, around here, Southern California, between now and, say, April. And so check it out. So let's bring her back on. Hello there.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you about details that you include in the book, because, for instance, Trader Joe's Dubliner cheese, which is like my favorite cheese of all time, I think. But, you know, you have so many specific details, and there are certain writers that are reluctant to use specific details like that because they fear that it'll date their work. I like it. I personally like it. I find it brings the work alive, and I want to be rooted in time, in the time where those details are. Talk about that.
I like to be specific. I don't know that my books will last the test of time. No one knows. You know, if you look back at, like, Robert Frost, during his lifetime, people would write, you know, on his book, if you liked Tim Hawkins, you might like Robert Frost. And, you know, he ended up being the poet that endures.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I just try to entertain myself, and I love to write about food, especially Dubliner cheese, which they never have, and neither does Whole Paycheck. And the best place to eat it is in Ireland, where I discovered it.
Hmm.
But I like to write about things like that. I like to go places I never get to live,
yeah,
you know, and write about them and eat cupcakes, though I don't in real life, mm-hmm. things like that. I think it's really fun.
Yeah, well, I think it's fun, too. And if you, I mean, you read some of the classics. I'm reading, one of the books I'm reading now is Anna Karenina, and there's so many specifics to that time. So would it be the same book without those specifics? You know?
Who knows?
Who knows? Writing about difficult topics is something you seem to be able to do. You bring in, I mean, in Finding Casey, from the start, there's a little girl in trouble, and more than just the little girl, there's other things going on that must be difficult to write about and to put yourself in and stay in for the duration of a book. So how do you do that without it just pulling you under? You know, how are you able to write and then come out of it at the end of the day and be happy, be content with life, or whatever you do to kind of just relax and unwind, enjoy yourself, and then the next day go back into the world and deal with what's going on?
I think over time you learn to let it go. I read many true crime accounts and court transcripts while writing Finding Casey, and some of the things I wish I didn't have in my head. But I try to look at it like this is a terrible thing that has happened. How can I write it either to raise awareness, to help someone else understand, to testify to the human spirit? Because that's the commonality, I think, in all of Finding Casey. The human spirit is strong. And that people overcome their difficulties, not like, we'll never think of that again, but somehow they become better people for it. I read transcripts from a couple of different trials, and I thought it was wonderful that the judge had marked out the graphic areas so that, you know, there's probably some weirdo out there who gets off on that. But I just was interested in the emotional, the physical, you know, how they were able to overcome that in time. You know.
Do you ever worry about writing about something maybe that is disastrous or that is, you know, some sort of challenging situation that hasn't happened, that is fictional, and worried about bringing it onto yourself? Have you ever worried about that? That I'm not going to write about that because maybe I'll attract it, and so I'm going to leave that one alone.
My friend Jody Pico says she writes about issues because somehow if she does that, it's like a spell that her kids will never experience.
Interesting.
That. I think that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, the longer you live life, more stuff happens, or you see it happen. I think the writer's job, in a way, is to try not to flinch, to witness something and make something good out of it. But, you know, I could be wrong in that. I just know that's how I try to live my life and my writing. I write about illness, chronic pain, situations that I'd say probably about 70% of us are in.
Right.
Because that's another conflict. That's a pressure you can put on the character. And they behave in a certain way because of their limitations.
So are you looking for as many pressures or conflicts as you can for your characters? And then with the idea that somehow they're going to find their way out of them? Or do you not know if they'll find their way out?
I say it's probably the latter. But they usually do, or they learn to live with it. When I wrote Solomon's Oak, Joe had just had his accident and had very bad back pain, which I happen to have. And I thought, okay, how does a person get back in the world, interact with other people when they're in chronic pain? And bad chronic pain. There's a scene in that book where he goes to refill his medication and he's hassled by the pharmacist. I've seen that happen. You know, people are so worried about drug abuse. But for the person who takes that medicine for chronic pain, you know, it's humiliating. What do you have to do? Lift off your shirt and show them your scars or bring your x-ray? I don't know. how you live with it and how you, I don't know, are able to set it aside when life requires something else of you. I find that really interesting.
I'd love to hear you read again.
Okay.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm with Joanne Mapson, who is about to read from Finding Casey. And if you want to hear the show from the beginning, it should be podcasts in the next week or so. So visit penonfire.com, and you'll find it. Okay.
I'm going to preface this with, this is actually a story within a story. The character of Laurel is a young mother whose daughter is in intensive care. She's, I think, 6 or 7, and she's very worried about her. And in order to get through her own life, she makes up a story, and the story actually tells more of the truth than she's able to. So this is Laurel reading to her daughter. "This is the story of the Princess of Leaves," I said. "Once upon a time, long ago," how long, Aspen would always say, "long enough that everyone has forgotten this story. There lived a princess in a castle near the woods with her parents, the king and queen. Now all princesses are beautiful, but what made her different from the other princesses was that she could sing so beautifully that if any bird within 100 miles of the castle heard her singing, they were compelled to fly near. If she sang long enough, eventually every person in the village would come to the castle. There they'd stand by the castle's moat, holding hats in hands, looking up to the highest tower where the silver birds perched on the castle walls. They waited for the princess to come out on the balcony so they could catch a glimpse of her. Every young man in the kingdom dreamed of asking the king for his daughter's hand in marriage once she became of age. Her blonde hair hung down nearly to her waist, curling on its own. Her eyes were hazel, which is the color of the tree of wisdom. Some days they were green and some days they were brown. Her smile caused even the saddest person to forget his troubles. The townspeople called her the Princess of Leaves because she liked to collect leaves from the many trees at the edge of the forest. This was especially true in late autumn, when every leaf reveals its true color. Often they would look up from their chores and see her pass by with the palace guard, keeping her safe. Autumn was her favorite time of year because that's when the earth begins to prepare for winter. The leaves turn gold, orange, scarlet, and rarest of all, a deep burgundy. That means red, but with purple in it, like a plum or a bruise at its sorest. Toward the forest, Princess Leafy would go, always with the castle guard to keep her safe. There are some people in the world so angry and unhappy that they stamp on flowers, mistreat animals, and want to make everyone as sad as they are. But you don't have to worry. I'll always protect you. Her mother, the queen, often warned the princess, "Stay clear of the darkest part of the forest. Not a single person who has ventured into the darkness has come back to tell the story. Promise me." The princess promised her mother she would do as she said, but sometimes even the wisest of princesses forgets, accidentally or on purpose. The princess picked up only fallen leaves because she never wanted to harm any living thing. In her heart, she believed every living thing deserved a lifetime, even spiders that weave webs to catch insects that might otherwise bite or pester you. Their webs are made of silk, and when it rains, drops catch on the web and they shine like diamonds. Beautiful things should be admired and then left alone.
Thank you so much. That was Joanne Mapson reading from Finding Casey. The ending, I found the ending very satisfying, and I wondered, as I was reading it and seeing how all the pieces were coming together, when you knew what the ending was and if you were writing toward it, if you knew the ending when you began.
I had a really hard time with this book because I foolishly showed the first 100 pages to two of my writer friends, and they didn't like it. And I spent months just agonizing and not writing. And then it came down to I had like 3 months left, and I had to write the book. So I went back to the 100 pages and told the story from there, and I just raced to the end. And when I got to the end, I thought, now how am I going to end this? And typed paragraphs and erased them, and I realized that it had already ended. It had ended how it ends, with the snow. And that was weird for me. Usually I spend a lot of time crafting an ending, or it takes like a day of not thinking about it to get, I don't know, it all put together and to sound right. That's where writing poetry can really help you, is it teaches you how to craft an ending that's resonant and memorable.
Well, so you showed it to two of your friends and then couldn't write because they didn't like it. Is it a good idea to show work early? Did you find it helpful in the end that you did show them, or did you go, you know what, next time I'm not going to show something so early?
Next time, I'm not going to show something so early. I thought about it for a long time, and I realized what I really wanted was praise. I wanted them to say, this is great, mm-hmm. keep going. But they're writers. Of course mm-hmm. they're going to write it differently.
Right.
I used to start out showing my pages to everyone and reading every chapter to my husband, and now I just want to get the book done before anyone reads it. And I think that, you know, that's a gradual kind of process you go through as a writer, the more mm-hmm. books you write.
Probably in the beginning you need encouragement, and you're hoping that people are gentle with you and encouraging you to go on, and then at a certain point it's like, maybe not, maybe don't show anymore.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you learn the hard way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what about rejection? Because that kind of leads into, you know, rejection is inevitable as a writer, especially in the beginning. And I mean, my point of view has always been rejection means that you're on your way to becoming published, because if you send out your stuff enough and you work on your stuff enough, eventually it's going to get better, and eventually somebody's going to publish it, or you'll figure something out. What's your relationship with rejection, and how do you, I don't know, instruct your students or help your students along, or what was your relationship with rejection in the early days?
It was just as you would imagine. It's devastating. We both used to belong to Fictionaires. Mm-hmm. Do you still go?
No.
I got to a point there.
But
where
Don Stanwood says hi.
Hi, Don. I got to a point at Fictionaires where everyone was getting published but me. And I remember coming home one night after Fictionaires crying, And my husband sat me down and said, you've chosen the most difficult profession in which, you know, to get a break. You're not a bad writer. You may not be the best writer, but if you keep working at it, you'll get it. And I went like years without getting anything published. I got little notes on the rejection letters, which I had no idea how important those were until later. And I wish I hadn't thrown away the one from John Scoyles and my New Yorker letters from the lady at the New Yorker. Oh my gosh, I think that those rejections were actually like blessings in disguise because it kept me working. It really kept me working hard. Then when I went to graduate school, boy, that was a totally different world, and no one understood writing about what I wrote about.
Because you were in Vermont.
Yeah, in Vermont they wrote about like cocktail parties and literary figures, and I was writing about riding horses and having a lot of sex. And I just sort of took that as a challenge, you know. I'm just going to write the hell out of this and put more sex in it and see what they think of that. And I stopped showing my novel in workshops because I knew it was not good for it. When I graduated, I came home and I'd gotten fired from my job, and I was depressed and walking around the house dusting as I do when I'm depressed. And the phone rang, and it was the editor from HarperCollins calling to tell me that she wanted to buy Hank and Chloe. And I'm like, who is it? She said, your agent has laryngitis. How funny is that? So it went from, like, you know, years of nothing to overnight, you got a deadline. And I think rejection, it's always going to hurt on some level. Bad reviews as well. But if you really want to do something, decide, who is it you're doing it for? The answer for me was myself. I want to know how this character manages to go on after having experienced this death or devastation or is lost. How do people manage to go on? That's like at the core of everything I write. And I can't find out till I write it. And these days there are so many options for publishing. So many people have, you know, self-published or published online and ended up getting book deals. Elizabeth Cohen is a writer I totally admire. She wrote a book called The Home on Beartown Road, which was a memoir of her father's Alzheimer's. And a writer I knew in Santa Fe said, would you read her collection of stories and write a blurb? And I'm like, I don't have time for this. I was very busy, and I said, I'll read one, and then I'll give like a sort of basic quote, because really, I'm busy 24 hours a day. I read the first story and I thought, oh, that was really good. I read the second story and I looked up and 3 hours had gone by. And I thought, this is a phenomenal book. I've never read stories about love that are looked at this way. So I wrote to the writer and I said, why are you publishing this with a small press? And she said, well, I have to have a book to get tenure and I just, you know, I don't have time. And I said, I think you're making a big mistake. I can tell you right now, this is a book my agent would take on. But she ended up self-publishing it anyway. And in 3 months, a big house had picked it up and said, we're going to republish this book properly. So what does that tell me? Good writing will always win out. So don't lose your faith in it. And if you end up only writing it for yourself, so what? You know, it's people who write love to write.
Right.
And if they don't, they should find something else
to do. What about that? What about self-publishing? And I mean, do you think that should be the last option? Or does it just depend? I mean, if you're somebody who doesn't want to go through, you know, months of trying to find an agent and, you know, lots of rejection probably before you find one, or maybe not. What do you think? I mean, should you self-publish thinking, you know, somebody might see this and it's good and take it on? Or
I think you should always try for the established publisher. For one thing, the contracts that come along with writing, the only person who can decipher them is either an entertainment lawyer who will take 10% or your agent, because they deal with these contracts all the time. I think it's probably a lot easier to get shafted if you do it yourself. I sent out 60 queries to agents when I was looking for an agent, and they all came back, no one wanted me. And the only way I got an agent was being recommended by another writer. That agent tried very hard to sell my horrible first novel, which we'll never speak of again. And then I wrote my second one and sent it to her in a rough draft form and said, do you think there's anything here worth salvaging? She copied it and sent it out, and it sold.
That was Hank and Chloe.
That was Hank and Chloe, and I was like, oh no, my last chance, and I didn't get to polish it up. But, you know, they made me rewrite it anyway. Mm-hmm. An agent is a really good person to have on your side, but they have to understand your writing. Look for an agent that publishes writers you admire or you think your writing would fit into that niche. It's always worth trying, and I think right now it's probably easier to get an agent because publishing is in such a flux.
Yeah. We talked about this before the show, and I wanted to mention it before we go off, and that is finding time when you're so busy. So many people are so busy, and and dealing with challenges in their life, their own illnesses, other people's illnesses, you know, just so many things going on now. How do you get into the zone you need to be in to write? What do you do with all that stuff, all the busyness, all the whatever you're dealing with?
Well, I look at my writing kind of like if you were a lawyer, you know, pleading a case in court, or a doctor removing an appendix. I can't let anyone disturb that, you know, or I'm not going to do a good job. In the morning, I'm not an early riser. I have to have two cups of coffee before I go to the computer, read the newspaper, go to the computer, answer a couple email, look on eBay, see if there's any cool old gringo boots for cheap. Then I start writing, and I write, you know, 4 to 6 hours. And sometimes I sit there for 4 hours, and the last 15 minutes are the only zone I get for that day. Or if it doesn't come at all, I'll rewrite, you know, or I'll look at something else and try to, like, think about what I'm going to do next. But it's sitting in the chair and waiting. One of the things I tell writers early on, trust your intuition. You know what happens when you can't fix something? You're stuck, you go to bed and you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning and there's the answer? You have to let your subconscious do part of it. And you can only do that through surrendering. Try really hard and you're not going to get that ending. Let it come and it will show itself. So the zone is elusive. Mm-hmm. You cannot make it happen. Alcohol doesn't make it happen any sooner, nor drugs. Not that I do either, because I don't. But I think a lot of people imagine that it's romantic to be half-hammered and writing. No, you need a clear head and you need to do the work. And they're words on paper. They're squiggles. You know, if you erase them, it's not going to kill you. And always back up. Oh, my God. The many times I have not backed up and had a problem, my husband's like, when are you going to learn? I'm like, I'm busy. I'm writing. Why would I think of backing
up? Right.
Myself?
Carbonite.
I do. I did get carbonite.
Carbonite's great.
It just does
it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're sitting there for those hours, will you just stay away from the internet, not check your email, or will you turn everything off and just stay there?
No, everything is on. I have caller ID and I won't answer it unless it's someone I know would only call me for an emergency. I flip in and out of the internet all the time when I'm writing because I like to glean details quickly. I used to go out and, you know, do research in the field, and now it's like right there, and I actually have files. You know, I need something.
Right.
It's in this file. I do go say hello on Facebook. I love Facebook. Crackbook, my friend calls it.
What about Pinterest?
I post Pinterest on there occasionally. Yeah. And Twitter, I don't like to Twitter, but occasionally I will.
Mm-hmm.
And on Facebook, I put up a writing quote every day, and people read
those.
It. But I, you know, I'm happy to like post a picture of the dogs mm-hmm. annoying me or whatever. Mm-hmm. But mostly I'm in my office. You know, I still walked all the way to the fridge to look and make sure everything's still in there, and then I come back. That's something that writers just do.
We just do. Thank you so much for being here.
It was my pleasure.
It's been wonderful. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been with Joanne Mapson. Her new book is Finding Casey, and she has 10 others and a collection of stories, Faultline, actually, that was published through UCI, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Called Pacific Writers Press.
And
Thursday night at 7 p.m., I will be doing my last signing in California at the Huntington Beach Bellaterra Barnes & Noble.
Is that on your website?
It is.
Okay. And that's joannemapson.com?
Yes.
So, there you go. So, Thursday night, and that's tomorrow night because this is Wednesday the 24th. So, if you're in Orange County or you're going to be here, check out Joanne and the reading and her website and so much else. Thank you for being here. We got to go. I'll see you here next week. Have a good week writing. Don't forget the page.